Am I ready to go? Anything else I need to do here?
I think you're fine.
Okay. I'm sure that Jean-Philippe gave the briefing, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so I'll just assume that he went through the important election that we just had two nights ago in Texas with Keisha Rogers completely wiping the floor in a primary election where she became the Democratic candidate for a representative for the House of Representatives in the Congress against the incumbent Republican, who's actually holding the chair of this guy his name is Tom DeLay, and he's a real schmuck, who we helped remove from office a couple of years ago because he was the Speaker of the House. He had Nancy Pelosi's seat. I guess, assholes are the tradition of the Speaker of the House for the past couple of years, I guess. But anyhow, we knocked on doors and everything around this district when Tom DeLay was in order to get him out, and we are the core of what replaced him with a Democrat, a guy named Nick Lamson, who then proceeded to lose to a guy named Pete Olson, who's now the Republican in there. So anyhow, it's the NASA district. I'm sure Jean-Philippe went through this, but I just want to reiterate it kind of from I'm an American, so I have a different perspective on this, but it's very important that Keisha won this election. And Lynn put out a statement on it yesterday, making the point that there is no Democratic and Republican Party right now. Both parties in the United States are virtually destroyed. The Democratic Party lost it back in 2006 when it decided to turn its back on LaRouche and listen to a couple of fascist bankers, one of whom is Felix Roatan, whose collaborator is a guy named George Shultz, who's been in and out of government. He was one of the main string pullers back in 1971 when he deregulated the entire world financial system and ushered in what's called the post-Bretton Woods system, which is an era of floating exchange rates of currencies. We're familiar with this stuff because we've lived with it for our entire lives, unless anybody was born before 1971 there. But George Shultz was the core of taking the system down. The Democratic Party decided to listen to these guys instead of LaRouche and ushered in the destruction of the United States auto companies, which went with it the destruction of the Canadian auto companies. Some of you guys remember this. Also ushered in just the destruction of our economy and prevented Dick Cheney, the former vice president, who's known for his bedroom antics with waterboards with his wife and other places. He likes waterboarding a lot and other types of torture. The Democratic Party prevented us from getting our way and impeaching this piece of junk Cheney, and instead kept him in and also pushed these completely crazy policies of, instead of what LaRouche is talking about, which is pushing for a banking reorganization connected with protecting people, homeowners, from foreclosure, from losing their houses. Instead, the Democrats, particularly in the Congress, under Bush, in his last year of office, instead of going with LaRouche's idea, pushed the bailout, which began this wave of bailouts internationally, which has completely changed the situation, where now we can't reform the international monetary system. And I'm sure JP went through this with you guys, but there's just earthquake after earthquake after earthquake, real earthquakes, but also financial earthquakes in Europe specifically, which are about to take down the entire world system. So the Democratic Party since 2006 has collapsed into just another arm of the British, essentially a British intelligence network inside the United States, a network of British agents, along with people inside the Republican Party. So right now we're under a president which is completely self-absorbed. The guy can't walk by a mirror without stopping for several minutes until his aides drag him away from the thing while he's pruning himself. who is into genocide. He could give a shit about these poor people down in Haiti who are now facing horrible rains, which have already killed dozens of people after this earthquake took out almost 500,000 people. Obama's, he digs it. He doesn't really care. Anyhow, the British have their arms deep inside the United States, and our parties don't work anymore. They used to function. The party, our two-party system, you know, along with all the myths and so forth, the two-party system actually does function. Unless your people lose their guts and go with foreign influence, like the British Empire. So this victory of Keisha is really, really huge, because the Democrats had their anointed candidate, I forget what the guy's name is, who they, you know, dumped money into the campaign and tried to get this guy to win. Keisha beat him 53, she got 53% of the vote. Her other two opponents got around 20 to 25% of the vote, respectively. So this is what LaRouche calls a landslide victory. This is unprecedented in the United States. You do not get margins of victory like this. So this is a shot heard around the world, and it's extremely important. But the point of my class tonight, I just want to make a point about Keisha's victory, which is what what Mr. LaRouche points out in this statement he put out yesterday, which is that the Democrats and other agencies associated with the British, and especially this Inter-Alpha group banking system, which is run by Lord Jacob Rothschild, one of the head oligarchs in the world, they're going to freak out. Right now, the freak out is being suppressed in various ways because they're a little bit scared of activating, they're a little bit scared of the consequences of reacting to Keisha's victory, because it could blow up in their face. What Mr. LaRouche is saying is that it's already blowing up in their face. No matter what they do, they're finished. Because what this was is a reflection of what Percy Bysshe Shelley describes as, he doesn't use the term, but he describes what Leibniz called as dynamics, which is that the population is now reacting to the fact that they've been betrayed, swindled, the president wants to try to kill them through this healthcare system, their entire economic system is destroyed, they're losing their houses, it's really bad in the United States, and it's getting worse. They're reacting now, essentially, by looking to what could be called a higher power, in its sense, a real higher power, not just, oh God, we got to do something about this, but the sense that there is an agency of justice in the universe that they can essentially pull the lever by calling on justice to fulfill itself, and that's what was actually expressed in Keisha's victory. Now, Keisha also, I'm sure JP mentioned this, but just to be complete here, the district that Keisha was representing is the so-called NASA district, which is the core of real scientific progress in the United States. It's a government agency created by the government, but it's run by civilians who are appointed. It's the core of all the productive work, but also the scientific work in the United States. We have scientific institutions all over the place, but this is the core because it's a government-funded outreach of man into space. Anybody who thinks that a private corporation or something like that is going to get into space, just look at the successes of Jeff Bezos and some of these other jokers who are trying to make a plane that goes into space, or who's this other guy that works for Virgin? Richard Branson. These guys are a joke. It's never going to get man to the moon. It probably won't get us much further than low Earth orbit, if they even make it. I mean, just imagine the public outcry if there were an accident in space by one of these space companies. Nobody would fly on these things anymore. It'd be completely finished. So, anyhow, Keisha's campaign was in this district, at a time that Obama has declared that the number one budget issue that he's willing to fight on, everything else is he's willing to negotiate and so forth, but the one that he's going to fight on, according to his closest advisors, like Peter Ort said, is to shut down NASA and shut down the manned space program in the United States and throw everything to the commercial sector. So Keisha's campaign was intersecting what remains as the core outlet of scientific creativity left in the United States, and indeed left in the rest of the world. And we can talk about what Russia and China and India and so forth are doing in terms of space, and we can talk about that a little bit later, but the point is that what Keisha was intersecting was the creative base of the United States. And it responded by saying, we're sick of President Obama, we want this guy out. We want to get back to what the United States really represents. So LaRouche claims that this is an aspect, this is a representation of the of dynamics, which is that people do not act as billiard balls, as kinetic objects that are just running into each other and, you know, I'm pissed off at this guy, so I'm just going to beat this guy up. But in times of serious revolution, as Percy Bysshe Shelley laid this out, and I'm sure that you guys can get copies of the paper that Shelley wrote on this, in times of revolution, people act in terms of a higher power. Even if it's not something that's inherent to themselves, they respond by acting in a somewhat more or less coherent way, which is an aspect of creativity. And this is what LaRouche calls the mass strike, and LaRouche is warning that a famous date is coming up, which is called the Ides of March, the 15th, where it's a point of reckoning for the United States and the rest of the world. So what I wanted to go through was a discussion of some material that Lynn has in his latest paper. It's called, can I get the title right? The Senile British Lion, Evil, Wicked, and Stupid. And I hope people have had a chance to look at some of this. But I'm going to go through some of the concepts that Mr. LaRouche has in there, and at the same time give a sense of where the scientific and creative work of the LaRouche movement fits in to the broader picture, so to speak. And at the same time, I'll give you a sense of what the project I'm working on. I'm actually working with a special group in the LaRouche movement in the United States called, it's called The Basement, because we work in the LaRouche's actual basement. I think it used to be a wine cellar or something like that. But we work in his basement. I work with a team, and I'm going to give a sense of what we're looking at and how the work, for example, the guys in Montreal, how their work fits into this and type of work. We're giving a sense, I'm going to give a sense of where science sits today and what the mission, what your mission should be in terms of that. Now, what Mr. LaRouche hits on over and over and over in the paper, and you can actually count it, it's virtually the subject of the paper, is first that the population of pretty much the entire world has been under cultural and cognitive attack, psychological warfare, essentially. Which now is being run mainly by the British, but it goes back, way back to around the 1500s, 1600s at the earliest, around a guy named Paolo Sarpi and some of his followers like Galileo Galilei, René Descartes, and Isaac Newton. But it even goes back further than that, to the core, which was a resistance to the first real scientific breakthrough culture, which was consciously scientific, which was the ancient Greeks, the Greek classical period, represented by Plato, his buddy Archytas, and so forth. The counter-reaction to that was Euclid. Actually, I'm gonna go into this a little bit more detail in a little bit. But the counter reaction to that was Euclid, and Euclid's geometry, which was an expression of Aristotle's work on essentially saying that the universe is fixed in the sense that the universe doesn't change. The universe has the universe doesn't change, and the universe is infinite. And if you think that you can know anything about the universe and change it, you are just a featherless biped, you idiot. You can't know anything about the universe. Essentially, Aristotle, he doesn't quite use those. He uses some of those words, but he actually spoke Greek, not English. But Euclid was an expression of that. Aristotle was explicitly a counterattack against Plato's method. Now, in reality, I'll just say, LaRouche counterposes that conception that there's a fixed universe that man cannot know. Man can only do statistical investigations of events with senses to say, okay, this happens then, and it happens, you know, so often. Therefore, I can come up with a statistical law to say that this kind of thing always happens. You know, if I drop a pen, that pen is always going to hit the ground, and so forth. So I got a law of the universe based on statistics. LaRouche says, instead of that concept of the universe, which is fixed, unknowable, you can't really do anything except hope for the best, is a concept of Albert Einstein, as he looked back at the work of Johannes Kepler. And you can read some of the things that Einstein says about Kepler. He wrote a couple of things on Kepler. But the most important for our purposes is the view of Einstein of looking at Kepler, where Einstein said Kepler's view of the universe represents the fact that the universe itself is finite but unbounded. In other words, it's not a universe that goes on forever. This is also called the bad infinity, right? That you can take a measuring stick and you can just keep measuring 1 meter, 1 meter, 1 meter until you get to the edge of the galaxy and you can just keep going. The universe is not infinite in that way. It's finite, but at the same time, it's unbounded. And you can see that if you look at any modern... you just go and get a copy of Scientific American or Discover magazine or whatever popular science magazines there are, or astronomy magazines that you can get at your grocery store or wherever. You see pretty quick that not only do astronomers take the concept of the universe way far, way farther than they have any way farther than they have any right to do, irresponsibly. But that they think the universe is essentially infinite. Right now the debate is, you know, at the edges of the universe, it looks like the expansion of the universe, which is also probably a hoax, the expansion of the universe, is it getting faster? Is it getting slower? At some point, is the universe going to collapse back on itself and create another Big Bang, which there's no evidence that there was ever a Big Bang, for example. This concept of the universe of, you know, it's an infinite thing, total, infinitely extended. In terms of Einstein's view of the universe, it's false. The universe is not infinite, it's finite. But this actually gets to a deeper principle. And again, if you look at even some of the observations of different galaxies and so forth, how far away we think they are, you can see that the universe, even according to the poor epistemology of the scientists looking at it today, you can see that the universe has a very peculiar structure. There are stars are all arranged in galaxies. We don't know of any stars that are not in galaxies, for example. The galaxies themselves are arranged in groups of galaxies that interact with each other. You have galaxies that look like they're combining in some way. You have galaxies that are active, which are producing stars at an enormous, tremendous rate. You have groups of galaxies. You have groups of galaxies, which are called superclusters of galaxies. You have walls of these superclusters. According even to the modern dogma of how to judge distances in the universe. So there is obviously some type of ordering to the universe, but the conditioning of the scientists today, they have to force even observations of an ordering into an already pre-established belief that the universe is infinite, you can't know how it works, all you can do is statistical guesses of what happens in the universe, instead of Einstein's conception. Now, LaRouche takes this idea further, and I'm going to be developing this in successive waves until the end of the class. LaRouche takes this one step further by saying that, and I have some suspicion that Einstein actually thought in this way too. LaRouche's concept is that the universe actually is a creative universe, that it's not a static universe, like Aristotle claimed. It's not a universe that's not changing. But the universe is changing. Of course, we know it's changing. But LaRouche says, and I'm going to go through some examples of this, the universe is changing, but in a way that's creating higher orders of power in the universe and higher orderings of the universe, more efficient and more powerful orderings of the universe, in the sense that the universe is not becoming more entropic, but the universe is becoming ever less entropic. Instead, it's actually accelerating away from entropy. LaRouche calls this concept anti-entropy. And that this creative universe, which is creative before man came on the scene, this creative universe is acting to increase the anti-entropy, and that man's intervention in the universe is that man is himself anti-entropic and creative in the same way that the universe is. And that the problem that man faces, or the, not the problem, the challenge that man faces is that universe is indeed finite and unbounded. LaRouche actually puts it in an interesting way, which is a lot like Einstein, where he says that the universe is finite in the sense that any state of man, in terms of man's knowledge of the universe, is immediately finite. And you can see this in economics, that if, for example, your state of technology, your state of technological development, stays fixed for a period of time, then your power to accomplish action in the universe, in other words, on the ground, is finite. You can do as much as you want, but there are certain levels of power that you can't attain. A good example of this is the fact that right now we don't have the technology to return to the moon. Now, some idiots will say that we never went to the moon, which is pretty lame. You actually have technological evidence that we went to the moon. I think it comes out of a pessimism. But right now, we're limited in our action. We can't get to the moon because our technological level is at one level. We've actually lost a lot of the technology that we had from the 1960s and 70s to the point that the most we can do now is ram shit into the moon, which we get valuable data. We just found out that there's a whole lot more water on the moon than we expected by ramming something on the moon, a piece of booster, a third stage booster called the Centaur stage, which itself was actually developed during the Apollo program. It was the third stage that the astronauts used to get to the moon. We ran that into the moon and it revealed a signature of water. But at this point, we don't have the technology to get back to the moon with people. So we're at a finite point where our action is finite. But our action is also unbounded because human beings have the ability to discover new principles about the universe and make new technologies based on those principles, which will expand our power in the universe. So therefore, it's actually an unbounded universe. At each stage of development, we're finite. But the universe itself is unbounded in the sense that human beings have the ability of increasing their power over the universe through discoveries. So this is the concept of the finite and unbounded universe. Now, the issue run into, we have, since about 2006, the LaRouche movement has established a pretty clear curriculum, an intellectual curriculum, because we do actually, contrary to some popular belief, we do actually intend to get back to the moon at some point. And if people have been reading LaRouche's material, and maybe JP went through this, but our current plan is actually to define a mission to send people to Mars as a very important next step for man. In light of that, we've defined an important intellectual curriculum so that we can begin generating scientists again, people who can think, who aren't infected with, what's called variously empiricism, liberalism, reductionism, positivism, and so forth. We want to generate new scientists who have the ability of discovering and expressing the anti-entropy of the universe instead of just repeating a bunch of stuff that's already been known, which any of you guys who are in college, you know that that's really all you're doing, is learning a bunch of stuff in textbooks to memorize how things were derived, especially if you're in any sciences. You're learning how certain things were derived, but at no point do you go through the real thought processes of the people who made the discoveries themselves, like Kepler or Gauss, or anybody who made any discoveries. If you're in chemistry, you get saddled with the periodic table. Nobody knows how, nobody talks about how Mendeleev discovered the periodic table anymore. Or even what it means to be periodic. We do. We're actually working through that. So part of the curriculum is to develop scientists again who can think in terms of anti-entropy. So we've defined what's called the narrow path. LaRouche defined this. He called it the narrow path, which is also known as the trunk line of science, which is get a sense of how real discoveries are made by looking at several specific individuals and key discoveries that they made, which then went through time. So you get a sense of what the real history of real science is, because you can see how ideas are developed and then built upon through generations, where the discoveries of one person suddenly are revived and developed more, sometimes hundreds or thousands of years after their death. And at the same time, you get a good sense of what we're actually up against in terms of the intellectual fight. So just some main stops on the narrow path. I'll go through a couple of these. The beginning, and people there can take you guys through some of this, back when Plato was on the scene making trouble in Greece, there was essentially an invasion after the Persian, after the Greeks beat the piss out of the Persians. There was a reinvasion from Asia, which took the form of what were called the Sophists, the Sophist movement, all teaching rhetoric and things like that. If you read any of the Plato dialogues, Socrates is essentially up against these guys. They came in, took over the Democratic Party, and said there is no such thing as truth. All there is rhetoric. All you can do is argue one way or the other. There's no such thing as truth. You can't really know anything. But you can argue like you know something. And one of the famous dialogues is a discussion that Plato has with a guy named Gorgias, who's supposedly the greatest rhetorician in Athens. And he's a teacher. He teaches rhetoric. Essentially teaching law, really, teaching lawyers how to argue really well. And all these oligarchs were sending their kids to be taught by Gorgias and his students. and then they would go off and become politicians and so forth. So Socrates, who had a mission to, he saw what the problem was. Socrates was Plato's teacher. He saw what the problem was, and he intervened to stop it. He got in this argument with Gorgias, and Gorgias went through this whole argument about how if he were put up in front of a crowd of people, along with a physician, a doctor, Gorgias could convince the people that not only was the doctor not a doctor, but that he himself knew more medicine than the doctor himself, even though Gorgias himself doesn't know anything about medicine, which is just, you know, a small example of this. And Plato's funny, or Socrates is funny. He says, this is kind of like flattery. It's like cookery. It's really just flattery. It's not for real. You're just lying. This kind of fight led up to a point, and all of the dialogues of Plato were to express what the fight of Socrates was, what Socrates' method was, and to tell people what happened to the guy, where we are. Because eventually Socrates was put on trial by the Democratic Party, which was populated by all the young people who had been sent to learn rhetoric, taught by the Sophist movement like Gorgias, which was in itself run from Delphi, explicitly, consciously, from the Oracle of Delphi. They put Socrates on trial for corrupting the youth, because he was going around showing the youth, or trying to show the young people that that this Sophist movement was not all it's cracked up to be, but they're actually a bunch of bullshitters. If you're
can you hear us? Peter?
Just calling back.
We just cut off 30 seconds ago. We're back on.
Do you guys see me?
Yep.
Can you see us?
We.
Okay.
So, anyhow, so Socrates is put on trial by the Democratic Party of Athens for corrupting the youth, because that's exactly what he was doing. He was going systematically to all these groupings of the youth that were being sent to Gorgias and the other Sophists, which were deployed by Delphi, which was a freaking banking house. It was the predecessor of the Venetian Empire and the predecessor of the Inner Alpha Group, which exists today in the British Empire. The Democratic Party put Socrates on trial because he was going systematically and showing them, the youth, that not only were they learning a bunch of bullshit, and if they wanted to essentially be human, they had to understand that the universe is composed of universal principles that they can know through dialogue and through experiment, but also for promoting the false gods, which is very interesting. Maybe we can go into that at another time. So anyhow, people know Socrates was soon after that. Socrates said, yes, you know, I'm guilty as charged. So, but all of you guys are, you guys are going to be punished eventually because of your non-adherence to a principle of truth. But I'll withstand whatever punishment you guys give me. And they ended up putting him to death. So Plato assembled these dialogues as organizing material, as organizing pamphlets, essentially. They didn't have the LaRouche Pack website for us at that. But they did have pamphleteering. They did write. There are a lot of dialogues. We have a good selection of the dialogues. He used this to organize. And at one point, he tried to organize it was a king. I think his name was Dion, either Dion or Dionysus, down in southern Italy, to mount an expedition to take out and destroy Delphi. Unfortunately, the sophist got to this guy first and put Plato in prison, so he wasn't able to do that. Instead, Plato wrote the Republic and began assembling his academy. But anyhow, the core of the whole thing, besides the organizing around Socrates' method, was a science driver project, which was intended, which was an unsolved problem, but it was intended to develop a scientific sense in the population, which would revive the Pythagorean method, Socrates' method, and the method of real Greek science called Spherix. And this was a challenge which was solved eventually by a guy named Archytas, who was the head of a city called Tarentum. The problem was to take a cube of a given volume and then make another cube that's exactly twice the volume. And the way you can formulate the problem is that you take a cube, like a cubic container, and fill it with a certain amount of water, and take another cube that's double the volume, which means you can take that cube of water and pour exactly twice of them into the second cube. They're both cubes. And at first, the challenge sounds kind of pedestrian until you start to try to do it. And you realize that it is actually within the bounds of any kind of geometry that you're messing with. Any kind of plane geometry, it is an impossible problem. And so anyhow, Plato used this as a... Plato and Archytas and Eratosthenes and various people who were involved with the fight used this problem as a science driver. It ended up not being enough. Delphi and the rest of these sophists and so forth ended up corrupting the culture so much of Athens that they ended up becoming imperial and launching the Peloponnesian War, and Greece has not been the same since. It was the downfall of the Greek, of the classical Greek period. And it initiated essentially a tradition of oligarchism, of maritime oligarchism, which has lasted up until today, which we're on the verge of taking the fuck down, which is what Keisha's campaign represents. But anyhow, this is the first step on the narrow path, doubling the cube, trying to understand what Archytas' method was. Because I'll tell you, some people have worked on doubling the cube before, but the way you double it is you recognize that volumes are not the same as any type of planar geometry. You usually start out by doubling the square, right? You know, people there haven't doubled the square. I'm sure Pascal and JP and so Matt tell you how to do this. But doubling the cube is not in the domain of doubling the square. Doubling the cube is in the domain of volumes, which means you have to start with volumes, and you look at the relationship between various volumes, like volumes of a cone, volume of various types of toruses, donuts, different cylinders, and you look at how the volumes relate to each other. And it was in that way, Archytas was in a place which was famous for its hydraulic systems. So they were very used to using combinations of different volumes of water. So from Archytas, you get a sense quickly that doubling a cube is not something that's contained within Euclidean geometry. It's something that's completely outside of Euclidean geometry. You can't start from anything that you know. It's a concept that's outside of all... It's a concept that's not inside the finite, but it's inside the unbounded. So, step one is doubling the cube. And I do suggest that people relook at this, because you get... you have to get your hands dirty and recognize that the universe is actually a physical universe. It's a universe of physical action. And the construction of something like that requires a discovery of the mind, because you can't see what the solution is until after you've figured out what the solution is. It's a discovery of a higher power. The universe is physical. So that's step one. The next stop goes through the Renaissance and some other guys that need to be investigated, which are Nicholas of Cusa, who discovered that the universe, he's the first person that actually defined explicitly what the infinite is, and showed that the infinite is where contradictions coincide, which means the universe is actually principled and it's susceptible of scientific discovery. He takes you through how the mind works in making discoveries. His book is called On Learned Ignorance. From his standpoint, you actually get more intelligent as you learn how much you don't know. Anyhow, his follower is the next major rest stop on, or action stop on the journey through the narrow path, which is Johannes Kepler, who died in the middle of the 30 Years' War, 1631. But he died after a complete whirlwind of scientific activity. He was in the middle of hardship. Most of his life he was spending raising money to pay for various things. But his mind was always intent on discovering how the universe worked. And the major works that he wrote on this reveal what he was really looking at. There are three major works. Mysterium Cosmographicum, the New Astronomy, and the Harmony of the World. And Kepler, the New Astronomy is the one that people usually know the most, because it's in that one that he discovered what are now known as the first two laws of Kepler. It's a complete banalization of Kepler, by the way, to say that he's got these couple laws, and that was his life's work, is to define that orbits of planets are elliptical, that the orbit, and if I use stuff that you don't understand in this, you know, you can ask later or people there can help you. He defined that, number two, the orbits of the planets sweep out a line in space that carves out an area which is always proportional, directly proportional to the time, so that in any given amount of time, the area swept out is always the same, which is a physical principle, but it's not the only thing that he had. And the third is that it's called a sesquialtera law, which relates the average distance of the planet from the sun to how long it takes to orbit one period. That the period is squared is proportional to the cube of the semi-major axis. But these laws are not the content of Kepler. And if anybody is in physics, this is what they've gotten. What you don't get from Kepler is how he makes a discovery, which I'm just going to give a schematic of it. Kepler's study was the relationship between the mind of the human being, the human investigator, and the principles of the universe itself. You get this immediately in his earliest work, the Harmony of the World, or the Mysterium Cosmographicum, where he shows that the universe is, to a pretty good approximation, the planets themselves order themselves. The average distance of the planets order themselves according to the radii of spheres, which are in between the various platonic solids. So each platonic solid, there are five platonic solids. The cube is one of them. You've got the tetrahedron, octahedron, dodecahedron, and icosahedron. Each one of them have a set of spheres associated with them, one that fits inside the solid, one that fits outside the solid. I don't know, maybe you guys have a model or something like that in there? In your office, or a picture or something? Yeah, that.
No, not that. I'm looking at that.
Not that.
Hold on.
Some people are working on it.
Kind of. But you showed that the ordering of the planets was organized according to the spacings governed by these platonic, they're called platonic solids, which are the regular solids. There's only five of these that you can make.
Matt has some solids here. All right, I've got the solids, but not the model that you're discussing. But
that's cool.
Five solids?
Can you show that each one you can have a sphere inside and a sphere outside.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You can imagine, for example, if you have a cube and an octahedron, that if you put a sphere on the outside of the cube, there's going to be a smaller sphere that you could fit inside the cube too, right? Mm-hmm. Same thing for this. Same thing for any shape. And they'll all be different ratios of spheres, basically. So the proportions are going to be different.
Same thing for all the solids, platonic solids.
Yes. Okay, it's kind of communicated.
All right, that's fine. And people can play with this afterwards, too. The point is that this is like, this is a developing thing. You ain't going to get all this in one day. So Kepler showed that the ordering, the series of planets, there were only six planets known at the time out to Saturn, were to a pretty close approximation ordered by the platonic solids themselves, which is solid geometry, which is involved in doubling the cube and so forth. But it's not quite exact. It doesn't quite give you everything about the planets and the distance. They're not exactly right. In fact, the only ordering that's exactly right is between Mars and Jupiter, which has the tetrahedron, the four-sided pyramid, in between their orbits. There it's exactly precise, but all the rest of them deviate a bit, which is the visual geometry. Kepler later on, 25 years afterwards, even though it wasn't quite right, he republished the book without changes, but added essentially another entire book to the book in terms of footnotes, in the form of footnotes, where he expanded it by saying you also have to look at musical harmonics. Now the next thing that Kepler put out was his new astronomy, where he got down and dirty with some of the data of a guy named Tycho Brahe, and determined exactly how the orbits of the Earth and Mars function. He actually got the orbit of the Earth first, and this is after, in every one of these books, he says, look, anybody who's not with Copernicus on the idea that the sun is not orbiting the Earth, if you're not with Copernicus, then you're not a real scientist. Although Kepler in the New Astronomy then starts to show that all the systems of the orbits of the planets were equivalent at the time, Copernicus and everybody else. So he determined how the planets orbit, which became necessary for a third part of his works, the harmony of the world. Now, the harmony of the world is really interesting. For the longest time, there was only one section of it translated into English, which is the part at the end, the part on astronomy, which people say, oh, this is the real science part. Everything else was just kind of a bunch of hooey. But the book goes through an investigation of the harmonics of visual space. So he looks at how he exhausts all the possibilities of plane geometry. In the second book, he exhausts all the possibilities of solid geometry. And then in the third book, he exhausts the entire geometry of sound, of music. So it's the harmony of the visual space, and then also the harmony of audible space. And he defines, for the first time, how a functional scale can be created, major and minor scale, and then he talks about the modes, but doesn't go that far into it. He defines musical harmony. And then the fourth is a strange book that people usually skip over because they say, well, you know, it's weird. He talks about astrology a bunch, and, you know, aren't we above astrology? Isn't astrology just bunk? Which it is. Astrology is indeed bunk. It's essentially just another form of mathematics. But Kepler, in this book, this is actually the most important one because he says, my study in this book is not geometry, and it's not music. My study is really how does the mind intersect the sensible world? Because you do have a sense of sight, and you do have a sense of hearing, but those senses are not your mind. If anything, they are receptacles of sense impressions from outside your body, of objects outside your body, which have to be producing some type of sensible effect, which is in coherence with your sense organ, So whatever you can see has to have some quality inside that seen object, which is the same as inside your eye. And the same thing with sound. Whatever is being heard has to have the same quality as what's operating inside ears. But then he does this funny thing where he leaves aside the fact, the question of how do the sense perceptions actually get inside your mind. They can get to your brain, but your mind is a little bit different than the brain. So he says, this entire book is a study of the geometry of senses, but then how your mind uses those senses to discover the functions of the universe. And then book five is the application, where he says, okay, now we have seen how our senses are organized and how the universe represents itself to our senses, but that the senses themselves aren't going to tell you exactly what's happening. And he returns to the Mysterium Cosmographicum and says, remember, we had determined the distances between the planets with the Platonic solids, and it didn't quite work. And he defines it again. He says, in order for it to work, we have to introduce the audible harmonies into astrophysics as an astrophysical quantity. And he goes through a series of hypotheses to figure out what aspect are you going to look at when you want to look at audible phenomena in the solar system. And people need to go through that series of hypotheses. But he ends up by showing that it's the relation of the speeds as seen from the sun, the angular change, the apparent change of the orbits of each of the planets. If those are coincident with musical intervals, then the solar system itself, the distances are roughly given by the Platonic solids. But then the motions, what are called the eccentricities of the orbits, are given by the fact that the sun has to be able to observe both the major and minor scales in the motions of the planets themselves. And he essentially designs a synthetic solar system and compares that with the real solar system, and it's extremely close. He has to make these little tiny comma changes throughout the whole thing. But he showed that the universe is understandable and coherent if you look at the differences between the sense perceptions, because they give you different aspects of one principle. And that principle itself, you can't see with either sense. Both senses give you a distorted view of whatever the principle is, in this case, gravitation. So Kepler discovered that, and then he made a forecast that even though the planets Jupiter and Mars fit the Platonic solids exactly, that's the place in between their orbit, that's the place where the musical harmony works the worst. The musical harmony is the poorest there. And so he hypothesizes that area is not quite understood yet. We need to look in that area more, because there is some type... he actually places an exoplanet in that region in the Mysterium Cosmographicum. So he's essentially forecasting the existence of a planet, which nobody knew about. So Kepler is stop number two. Stop number three, it gets a little bit hairy, because there's some problems with Carl Friedrich Gauss. There's a track to follow in Gauss, which is pretty clear, but then the problem with Gauss is that he's a little bit opaque. Kepler was living during the 30 Years' War, but he felt that he had to publish exactly how he made his discovery. So you can follow step by step his thought processes. The guy tells you every single thing about what he did. He tells you what he's wearing on the day. He tells you every hypothesis, every wrong hypothesis. He takes you down roads that are completely wrong. He says, haha, you know, this might be exhausting for you, and we know it's not right. You know, it's taking you a couple hours, but remember this. I was on this track for 4 years. I was going down this wrong road. So he takes you through every wrong hypothesis so that you have to come up with the hypotheses. He makes his hypotheses compelling so that you will rediscover his ideas and rediscover the principle of the universe, the principle of gravitation, as he did. So Kepler will become alive in your mind. Gauss, on the other hand, is a little bit different. Because Gauss one of his collaborators, I forget whether it's Jacoby or might be Jacoby, said that Gauss built a magnificent structure. Every one of his works was a magnificent structure, which was technologically new. But he wiped out all evidence of the scaffolding, so you don't know how he actually constructed this thing. Because what Gauss does is he makes wild discoveries. The key one to look at is how he discovered the orbit of the first asteroid and then the successive asteroids after that in a belt that lies between Mars and Jupiter, which is what Kepler forecasted based on his juxtaposition of the two senses. Gauss recognized first that it was an orbit of an asteroid, and then he calculated the orbit, and then he published a cover story, which we worked through it in the basement. This is the project that I was brought in on. We worked through it, and it became really clear that his published report on the discovery is not quite right. For example, if you follow his published report, and we've republished it in English so that people can read it. I don't know if it's in French, but it's in English at least. Or people can read German, it's in German. It's called his summary overview. First of all, it doesn't quite give you the right orbit of... It doesn't give you the orbit that he submitted. It was actually a type of a scientific contest to figure out the orbit of this object. His submission doesn't reflect what you get out of following his step-by-step instructions. But then at the same time, there are letters that he writes to specifically a guy named Olbers, who was one of his collaborators, which he brings in details that they are completely left out of his writing on the subject. Most of Gauss's work is in the form of, here's a theorem, and then he goes through a mathematical derivation of the theorem, which in a lot of cases, a lot of these people who looked at Gauss, they didn't understand how Gauss made these logical jumps in mathematics. There's this famous case of a guy in the United States who was translating Gauss's works. He was in the Navy, and he was translating Gauss's works on astronomy so that the Navy could actually navigate better. It was for celestial navigation on the seas. Who would have thought? But this guy wrote a whole thing about how he tried to follow every step in Gauss's determination of the orbit of Ceres, and he couldn't get through the whole thing, and he's convinced he had to come up with his own derivations because some of Gauss's didn't even work. Gauss had wrong calculations in his calculation, but he ended up with the right result. So the question you run into with Gauss is, what was this guy really thinking? Because there's a discovery there. It's a real live discovery. It becomes known as Gauss's discovery of the complex domain and the discovery of curvature. But you're not going to find it written down by him anymore in the same way that it's written down by Kepler. You have to go through Gauss's work knowing that he's creative and knowing that you can figure out, if you rediscover his discoveries, what he did. And then you look at the mathematics and figure out what his cover story was. And we've laid out some tracks through Gauss so that you can do that, specifically in his number theory and in his astronomy. The next step, and this is where it gets a little bit hairy, because you can't... Here's where the tree essentially branches. The next step would be Riemann. But Riemann is a little bit tougher to get a sense of because of the mathematics. Because it seems like he's doing mathematics, and people have a tendency in, globally extended European culture of resorting to mathematical derivations instead of an honest investigation of how these people think. Because Riemann took off from Gauss, he gave his dissertation for his habilitation, his doctoral thesis, where he said that the concept of geometry has been, he says, shrouded in a shadow for over 2,000 years, since Euclid, and that the shadow has not been lifted, the shroud has not been lifted until now. And he says, go back to Euclid, the concept of the universe laid out by Euclid is flawed because it's based on an axiomatic structure. And instead, you have to investigate how the universe works in terms of physics. And so the last sentence, it's a, you know, Lin keeps, he thinks this is hilarious, but it's this mathematical, it's this habilitation of the mathematics department. But at the end, he says, you know, we've gotten to the end of math, of what mathematics can teach us in terms of the shape of the universe that can be known through mathematics and the core fundamentals of real geometry. We've gotten to the end of what you can get through mathematics and geometry. We've got to now take a stroll over to the Department of Physics, where they actually work on the universe instead of work in the mathematics office, where you don't really interact with the universe. You just kind of talk to yourself all day. So Riemann is, he's the next step, but we found that the best way to get at Riemann is actually to come at it from the other direction. Because Riemann was conscious that the universe was also knowable only in terms of human creativity. And he wrote a couple of notebooks about this. It's what he calls Geistesmassen. But that the universe, all laws of the universe, all physics of the universe, need to be investigated from the standpoint that the universe is functions, that the universe contains a human mind, which is a real entity and has real effects. Therefore, the properties of the human mind, which can only be known by investigating the human mind itself, the properties of the human mind should be used as a fundamental basis for investigating the properties of the universe itself. And so that's the standpoint he was doing all of his scientific work. But it's easier to get a sense of that not by reading his mathematical works, unless you're pretty crafty, but by going straight to two of his followers, which are Einstein and Vladimir Vernadsky. And so this is where we come full circle, because Einstein's, the core of Einstein's work is looking at Kepler and saying Kepler's discovery was finite and unbounded, in the sense that Kepler was working against the predominant science of the time, which was Aristotle. The whole universe was Aristotelian, according to the learned peoples of Kepler's time. So Kepler had to break from this suppressive, largely political, politically imposed view of the universe, which was Aristotle. He had to break from that and develop a new concept of the universe, which was essentially freeing man from Aristotelianism. So the universe is finite but unbounded in the sense of Kepler's discoveries. Now, Vernadsky, I'm going to go through some of the material of Vernadsky, put into context the latest, like the place we are now into context, and then I'll end the class and do some questions. Vernadsky, the importance of Vernadsky is that he did what a lot of people do when they start studying the natural world, which is you wonder, what is life? You can define what crystals are. You can define what non-living things are. You can define chemistry. But what is life? But Vernadsky recognized that you can't answer that type of question in that way. He was principally a geochemist, which is looking at how the chemicals and minerals of the earth distribute themselves. And Vernadsky's big insight, the guy was a complete creative genius. If you guys read any of his works, you see that his mind is light years ahead of anybody today except for Lin. Much less his collaborators in Soviet Russia back in the 20s, 30s, and 40s. But he was primarily a geochemist, but he came up with the idea of looking at the placement of minerals, how minerals and loads of resources and so forth were placed, and particularly how radioactive resources were placed, but how they were placed in terms of the principles of the universe, cosmic forces. he said in terms of celestial mechanics, how is the structure of the Earth organized in terms of the functions of the solar system and the galaxy? But then even deeper, how is the structure of the Earth determined by life on the planet? And through his work, he recognized that life, this is later on, this is in about the 20s and then 30s, he recognized that life represented a different, let me put it like this. Vernadsky looked back at a couple scientists, which recently there was a video put out on one of these guys called Pasteur, Louis Pasteur. Video was put out, and I suggest everybody watch it, because this is a crucial element of Vernadsky's worldview. Pasteur demonstrated that there are processes in chemistry which cannot be defined or explained in terms of chemical events, chemical reactions. And this, his particular domain of investigation was fermentation of wine, right? If you study Pasteur, you get to drink a lot of wine, so it's really good. He studied beer, too. He's a fun guy to hang around. But he showed that life, living processes, particularly yeast, act on chemical processes in a way that chemistry cannot recognize. That essentially what a living creature can do, what a living process can do, is look at the optical properties of chemicals. His example was called tartaric acid, a special type of acid that you get, which can be crystallized after fermentation of wine. That yeast will pick out, there are two types of this crystal, which are chemically identical. You cannot tell them apart by weight. All you can do is tell them apart by what they do to light. They actually bend the polarization of light in two different ways. So that's the only way you can distinguish these two types, what Pasteur called enantiomers, or isomers. Pasteur showed that this is not a chemical property, but it's an optical property. You can't determine the property by chemistry, but these little living, you know, buggers, yeast, can figure it out right away. They can tell right away which is enantiomer, and they will clear out a mixture of both of these types of acid. They'll clear out the left-handed version so that all you're left with is a right-handed version, for example. So Pasteur said that there are processes in chemistry which are not chemical and not observable in terms of chemistry or any other type of non-life, but that life itself has chemical properties which are outside of chemistry. So Vernadsky took that and said, aha. And then he found other properties. He said, aha, life is not just a different phenomenon in the biosphere, but life is endemic. There's no beginning to life. He says it's been on the Earth forever, since the beginning of the Earth. That there was no first life form. But that second, all life represents a different curvature of space, a different structure of space. That you have two things in one area. You have a rock, and then you have a fossil. Both of those exist as if they're different spaces. They're different geometries. And for example, in the living geometry, you have curved surfaces. Where in the abiotic, the lithosphere, so to speak, you have a lot of straight lines. Anything that's rounded is only rounded in the large, but if you look close, you have crystal structure all over the place. So Vernadsky said, what you're looking at with life is a different state of space. And then he went further late in his life to say that that human life actually represents a third state of space, which he called the noosphere. And that each of these phases have their own fossils that they produce. For example, the lithosphere produces fossils, which are any rocks that you go and pick up. Or the planets, for example, are products of the lithosphere, and so forth. The biosphere has its own fossils, which among which are fossils, right? You can find fossils of animals all over the place in different museums. Sometimes, if you're lucky, you'll find fossils. You have chalk. Chalk is a fossil, for example. The biosphere produces its own type of fossils, which are not reproducible in a chemical lab or in a crystal growth laboratory. They're only produced as the material from the abiotic is siphoned through biotic processes. So another aspect of the biosphere is that no biological creature or organism is fixed. You'll never, like a rock will stay that same rock for ages. And some, the oldest rocks we know of are over 4 billion years. They haven't changed. But every living process, as it's living, changes continuously. Bernoulli called this the biogenic migration of atoms, that all the matter is being siphoned through. It goes into the living process and is held there for a certain amount of time and then ejected as a living fossil. He calls it living matter, as a fossil of life into the biosphere. And one of the most well-known fossils in this way is actually iron ore deposits of iron, which you guys might have some of that up there. I don't know. Around like Wisconsin and Minnesota and Ontario, there's a lot of iron, which was placed as part of a biological process. So life takes the lithosphere, sends it through, and turns it into part of the biosphere, which now it has a completely different structure, which it couldn't get through chemistry. Now another aspect of life, which is very important, is the representation of time in life. And Vernadsky, at this point, actually references Einstein in several papers that he wrote in the 1930s. Einstein's view that space and time are actually, they're not separable, but that you have a physical space-time in the universe. And Vernadsky said, in the same way that you have properties of space of life, you're gonna find special properties of time in living processes. And the way to look at this is to look at some of the fossil record of the Earth. And what you see is that there's never, if you look at the progression of species, people know what I'm talking about with the fossil record, yeah. Right? Like, there used to be dinosaurs on the Earth, for example. A long time ago, they got wiped out. Before them, you had other creatures. Most of the life has lived in the oceans. For the longest time. The earliest life we know of was in the oceans. There was actually a late development that creatures started walking on the lands during what's called the Carboniferous period. But that you have always a development of life, upwards development of life, where you're always getting new species which are more and more and more capable of doing different things with new abilities. For example, eyes were a development. Trilobites are actually the first creatures that ever exhibited eyes. Before that, no creatures had eyes. There were creatures that had photosynthesis, which is a type of collection of radiation from space, from the sun. But eyes were a later development. Other types of senses were later developments. So you have new capabilities being developed through the fossil record. You have these great transformations of the type of life on the Earth when you have certain conditions reached. For example, there was an event in the early history of the Earth where oxygen content in the atmosphere had built to a certain level that it became super toxic to all the creatures that were alive, which forced the intervention of evolutionary processes and made possible the development of animal life, which breathes oxygen, so-called aerobic metabolism. So you have these events. So you had a huge die-off of creatures at this, they call it the oxygen catastrophe. But then you also have the development of new creatures which have faster metabolism so they can do more. They're the beginnings of what's needed for animal life and specifically human life on the Earth. So you have an upwards development, always an upwards development. And Vernadsky said that this represents the fact that you never have a reversal of time in life. Life is, he says, that there's a polar time vector with life. It only goes in one direction. And you have various durations of life. It says you have generational time, which is over generations. But then you have time of evolution, which is marked out by the creation of new species, new types of species. And each of these is different. You have time marked out by the development of new categories of creatures. Like the dinosaurs were a category of creatures which lasted longer than most of the life we know of on the Earth. It lasted almost 200 million years. After them, you had the wipeout of the dinosaurs and various other types of creatures, and the introduction of warm-blooded mammals and other types of mammal-like creatures, which were necessary for the development of us, cognitive man. So, irreversibility of time is another aspect of the fact that life represents a different geometry, a different state of space-time than non-life. Now, the deal with man, the deal with man, Vernadsky referenced another scientist named James Dwight Dana, and this is all stuff that's on the list, essentially, on the narrow path. That Dana recognized that you can categorize advancement of... Oh, by the way, all this is completely anti-Darwin. There's no Darwin in this. Darwin is a completely... he's a historical non-necessity. You don't need Darwin for shit in life sciences and evolution. Because you can define the evolution of creatures based on higher development, what LaRouche calls anti-entropy, higher and higher forms of development. And what James Dwight Dana showed is that it's not a random course of events that create new traits in creatures, but it's an ordered direction of development towards higher and higher states of development of the central nervous system, which becomes the core of what makes us human, which is that our central nervous system acts like an antenna to resonate with what we now know of as the third domain, which is human creativity. So human beings are uniquely creative because we have a biological apparatus which is itself in tune with some type of higher power, which we'll call creativity. Now, what you see in all of this, oh yeah, the other thing I wanted to point out is what we're doing now. Actually, no, I can go into that in a second. So what you see as a result of this is that there are these three phase spaces identified by Vernadsky. The lithosphere, the biosphere, and then the noosphere represented by man in human cognitive creativity. All of them are anti-entropic. You have the development of higher species of element in the solar system, in the early solar system, elements that didn't exist yet, all the way up to the radioactive elements, creative. You have the development of anti-entropy in the fossil record, headed towards higher and higher orders of development of entire communities of creatures. The entire Earth is essentially reshaped as it reaches different stages of development of life. Anti-entropic. Both of those are driven by nature itself, without human intervention. But the third domain is also anti-entropic, human development, in the sense that we create higher states of organization in the universe also, in the form of scientific discovery and the development of technology, which allow us to wield principles that are known only in the way that Kepler defines knowability of principles in terms of harmonics, that you're discovering principles that are not sense perceptible. And then we wield, in a sense, we switch on those principles and we use them, even though they're principles that have not been, you know, accessed on the Earth for a long time, like, for example, fusion or even antimatter reactions. Or there's this type of a laser called the petawatt laser, the femtosecond petawatt laser, which is so powerful that when it vaporizes gold, the gold produces gamma rays, which themselves decompose into both positrons and electrons, which is called an antimatter gas, which doesn't exist anywhere in the universe because it evaporates instantly because the antimatter will react with the matter and just obliterate itself. But you can create a sustained gas of antimatter with these new lasers because of the intervention of human technology, of human discovery. So this third domain is not necessarily driven by nature. The third domain is willful. We wield anti-entropy. We wield discovery to increase anti-entropy in the universe according to our own will. We decide to make interventions and change the universe. So this gets back to LaRouche's newest paper on the senile old British Empire and what they've done to humanity. Because what you see is that the universe is creative, and that man, in the sense that it's finite and unbounded, that there's a succession of higher ordered states in the universe which increase the possibilities, the potential of the universe, but that it's all essentially automatically anti-entropic through the lithosphere and the biosphere, but that there's one domain which is willfully creative and willfully anti-entropic, which also works the other direction too. If you're not willfully anti-entropic, then you're willfully entropic by staying in the same finite state and not moving higher and higher into new finite states through the unbounded universe through discoveries. If you don't do that, then you sit in a finite domain, and I'll give it an economic example of this in a second. You sit in a finite domain and essentially run into finite events which will act to decrease the population and create outbreaks of horrible diseases and essentially wreck society pretty bad, which could lead to the destruction of the human race and other life on the earth. But that this willful creativity with you as a human individual created in the image of the creative in the image of the creative being of the universe, whatever created the universe and whatever created itself, you have a moral responsibility, a moral obligation for progress and new discovery. And I just want to read really quick, and then I'll end in just a couple of seconds. I want to read a section from LaRouche's paper, just a couple sentences, so you guys can get a sense of how this dude thinks. He says, the crucial question so posed is man's intellectual power delimited by the ability to play childishly clever tricks in the universe? Or is that a power which we may recognize as an ontologically existing, obligatory form of capacity? Is it also an obligation requiring human individual action of a certain kind which is necessarily specific to the human species? Is man's nature, therefore, in the nature of an obligation imposed upon us by the great power which rules the universe? Is God, contrary to Aristotle, as Philo of Alexandria insisted on this point theologically, is God a self-created being such that we must draw from evidence supporting characterizations of Genesis 1 the presumption that man and woman have that consequently obligatory likeness? So much for LaRouche. So that is the big question in science. Is it, you know, are scientists just, you know, kind of playthings? Is it just, you know, if you decide you want to go and be a scientist and make some money that way, then that's your prerogative? Or is it your obligation as a human being to investigate how human creativity works and increase the anti-entropy of the universe? And it doesn't mean becoming a computer programmer, all right? So anybody who thinks that, like, science is just sitting behind a computer and, you know, doing logical calculations and stuff like that, you should take a cue from Einstein, who said that all of his scientific theories and all of his scientific breakthroughs came underneath the power of a violin. That his creativity came from the creative work he would do in music. And you actually start to see this all over the place. Everybody who made any real discoveries was investigating at the same time music and art. because that's where the creativity comes from. So it's a moral issue. So I'll just end by giving a sense of what we're looking at. Oh, yeah, giving a sense of what we're looking at and where we're headed. Vernadsky made his hypothesis was that life and all development on the Earth is intimately connected with cosmic forces, cosmic processes. And one thing that he put a big spotlight on right near the end of his life was the discovery of what are called cosmic rays, which are strange phenomena. You know, you should read some of the history of how these were discovered. At first, we thought they were a strange kind of radiation. They were producing weird effects in what are called cloud chambers, streaks of clouds, cloud streaks, like contrails, like aircraft, like when an aircraft flies overhead and produces the contrails. You get things like that from these strange rays, which a man named Hess discovered get more and more intense as you go up in the atmosphere, which he hypothesized came from the sky, came from space, which is why they're called cosmic rays. We know now that they are predominantly atomic nuclei. All the elements, all the way up, all the way past uranium, that are moving incredibly fast and have very strange effects. Like, for example, they're involved with producing weather. For example, the clouds that you're seeing are low-lying clouds, rain clouds, particularly, are created by cosmic rays. This is proven now, beyond a doubt. And that the mediator of these cosmic rays lies within the sun and also within the Earth in our magnetic fields, because they're susceptible to magnetic particles that are reflected and directed through magnetic fields. So when the sun is at a particularly low period, an inactive magnetic period like it is now, you have an influx of cosmic rays. And a man named Henrik Svensmark hypothesized and then proved, and then he has a whole bunch of collaborators which validated this hypothesis, that the onset of ice ages is due to the influx, increasing flux of cosmic rays into the atmosphere of the Earth, which comes from decreasing magnetic field of the sun, possibly the travel of the Earth through the arms of our spiral galaxy, which actually the passage through the arms has been timed out with past ice ages that we know of. And that right now we're entering into a new ice age, not a global warming. The global warming thing is kind of ridiculous if you consider the power of cosmic rays. Anyhow, so we're looking at what cosmic rays have to do with the Earth, but specifically what they have to do interacting with life. Because we know that the major extinctions that have occurred coincided with these ice ages. We also know that life responds in very interesting ways to various types of radiation and light. And so what we're looking at is, what is that interaction? What's the scope of that interaction? Does it have bearing in the direction of the development of life towards man? Is there a creative aspect of these cosmic rays? And are the cosmic rays part of the domain of the noosphere instead of the lithosphere? Do these cosmic rays represent a creativity in the universe? What is the intervention? And so the experiment that we pose to do, there have been experiments that show that cosmic rays, they're what are called circadian rhythms. This is just a small example there. Circadian rhythms. Your circadian rhythm is that when it gets late, you pass out, you go to sleep, right? Every human being has to sleep for a certain number of hours at night. Usually when people join the LaRouche movement, they forget that part because they're so excited about the ideas. But and they stay up all night. But you recognize that sleep is a circadian rhythm. It's a daily cycle that your body goes through. And there have been investigations of how these cycles work. And there's a very, very interesting hypothesis that's backed up by experiments that many of these circadian rhythms are due to changes in cosmic ray flux. So there's a direct intervention of cosmic rays on life, which might have very interesting bearing on the change of form of life. They all, so I'll leave it at, I'll leave that part at that. So what we propose as an experiment is to revive the Mars mission. We need to make new scientific discoveries of new principles in the universe. Cosmic rays and the fact that they're produced in such energetic places like the Crab Nebula is a domain that is unexplored, and there are principles that exist that we don't even know about, which relate cosmic rays and living processes. Therefore, what we have to do is get outside of our Earth's gravitational field with biological creatures, including people. We need to take trips from the Earth's moon to Mars. We need to build ships that can accelerate at one Earth gravity so that people don't have to deal with the fact that they're losing gravity for 200 days. We can take trips which take 2 or 3 days to get from the Earth's moon to Mars in an accelerated trip, in an accelerated craft. Then we would see we would run into new phenomena. What are the effects of cosmic rays on life? At first we'd want to put probably animals on board these accelerated ships, like dogs and monkeys and things like that, or lab mice, to see what happened to them. Because you don't really want to do that with people. We do experiments that could injure or harm biological creatures with animals first, and then we do it on. Then when we figure out what's going on, we can figure out how to preserve life so that we can get people to the surface of Mars through a realm of new scientific discoveries and initiate the human-man colonization of the entire universe off of our planet. Which obviously means, step one is we need the American President Obama out of office because he's a big fat roadblock, or a big tall roadblock in the way. So anyway, I'll stop there. Do people have any questions? I'm sorry, I didn't mean to go this long, but hopefully it was worth it.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah, anybody.
Should I go up there? Or?
Yeah, just go to the room. We're just saying.
Yeah, if you got questions, just shoot.
So you were speaking of, can you hear me all right?
Yeah.
Okay, good. You were speaking of something that James Dwight Dana was talking about, right? How the direction of evolution has been towards development of a central nervous system, eventually perfected in humans, which acts as an antenna for some higher power, the power of creativity. So I got that right. Does that have any relationship with something else I've heard of, kind of also, non-mainstream science, the idea of morphogenetic fields? Do you guys work with that at all, or?
Yeah, absolutely.
And I was wondering talk a little bit about those and what kind of scientific projects are going on around that.
Yeah, I mean, just to be clear about Dana, I don't think his idea wasn't the human beings act as an antenna. That's Mr. LaRouche's development on that.
Okay.
But Dana proved beyond a doubt that there is indeed a direction of evolution, that it's not a succession of little tiny mutations in your DNA that give you, a little bit of, whatever, better looking ass or something like that so you can get, a date easier. But that the direction of evolution is through new features which come about suddenly but are in the direction of a development of the central nervous system. He called it the head region. It's called cephalization. The development of more and more of concentration of the senses in the head, and the devotion of more and more parts of the body towards the head region. So he said that the most advanced creature in that sense is man. But there was LaRouche's concept actually that the development of the brain is not the mind. The brain is the brain is a biological organ that is a receptor for your sense perceptions. You get the electrical signals and chemical signals in the brain. But then your mind looks at these signals, and you now have the opportunity to decode them, essentially. And all life, according to Dana, is actually vectored towards a human type of being, which is able to do that. Now, in terms of the morphogenetic field, yeah, this is a Gurvich, Alexander Gurvich, who is a Russian guy, worked with Vernadsky for a period of time. He's an interesting guy. He grew up studying Beethoven. He wanted to go into being an artist. He's a common, extremely creative guy. Very, very excited about creative work in general, specifically music. But he failed his exam or something like that when he tried to get into art school. So he decided to become a doctor instead. But his early studies were on the development of the human embryo, or embryos, like sea urchin embryos, frog embryos, and so forth, to look at how they develop. And he showed, in parallel with a couple other workers, like a man named Hans Spemann, that the development of the embryo, he said it fills out a space that exists for it before any matter is in that space, so that certain features fill out from the more general to the more detailed. So, and his idea is that they grow almost as if the structure is there before the growth takes place, which became known as the concept of some type of a morphogenetic field, what causes the form of creatures. And Hans Spemann had the same idea. He was looking at what was specifically called the organizer, which was a section of the early embryo, I think called the gastrula, when the embryo is just a collection of cells that's in the shape of a ball. There's a section on that embryo which becomes the spinal cord, and he did various experiments showing that that section had some type of morphological control over the rest of the embryo, but that it wasn't a simple, the instructions are in that area, but that some type of field was located in that area. Anyhow, that was in parallel with Gurvich. Gurvich later on, as he was looking at the types of cells that are the dividing cells, the so-called mitosing cells, he wanted to find some type of overall hypothesis that would organize all of the results that people were coming up with, from embryology, but also just from simple biology, looking at the division of cells and the growth of creatures. He wanted some type of concept that would contain all of that, and he discovered that cells radiate a wavelength of light, which he determined was ultraviolet. He took onions and took the root structure, which were known to be really symmetrical, and aimed them like that. Can you guys see that?
Mm-hmm.
So that this is one root, this is another root. So he would aim them like that, and he'd show that on this section of the root, there would be a dissymmetry that formed in the growth of the cells, which he showed was disrupted when you put different types of plates of glass, quartz, metal, and things like that, paper, in between the two root structures. Some of them would block the effect, some of them wouldn't block the effect, and he narrowed it down to ultraviolet range of the spectrum. So he said there's some type of radiation being given off by these cells, and then he published the results, and it's funny, he's got a paper on 20 years after his discovery, and he just rages about people who tried to reproduce the experiment, but kept failing, and essentially said, Gurvich must have been wrong, because we're not getting the same results. And Gurvich kept saying, look, it's an extremely weak radiation. It exists, but since it's so weak, you guys are investigating it like, I know we got this term in the United States called ham-fisting. They're ham-fisting the thing, the experiment, because they're not using fine enough measurements to register the effect. He died, leaving a body of work on this morphogenetic field. Recently, there have been a lot of people who have been reviving this work, for example, a guy named Voyekov in Russia, who we've been in touch with. We're looking at this from the standpoint that there is a radiation field that's specific to life that there's virtually nothing known about because there hasn't been a whole lot of work done on it, that definitely has bearing with the development of the form of the light, and we need to look at it more. And there probably is some interaction with cosmic rays and so forth. But again, this is a kind of study that you're only going to be able to do so much on the Earth because you have all the other background fields that you're dealing with, like the Earth's magnetic field, there's an electric field on the Earth, and so forth. We really need to get into space to do real experiments in this area. So yeah, Gurvich is another guy we're looking at, and you guys should look at some point.
Actually, I have two questions, but maybe you guys already know this. What is it exactly, like in a phrase, can you summarize what you're trying to say with everything you've said tonight? Like, after all of these things that you've studied, what's your main point? What is it that you want to, like, you're trying to say something, but I don't know what it is.
Like, the universe is creative.
So
the universe is creative, but the point is that so are you. And what we need right now politically is a lot more people that are consciously creative. And we need to be able to express that in terms of the economic policy of nations around the world. And so, I mean, like, for example, the reason we're hammering on saving NASA in the U.S. is because that's like the main outlet of creativity. All development of the human population comes from this aspect that you represent of the universe. The ability of us to support human life on the Earth depends on discovering new scientific principles, new creative principles, and applying them as technologies. And if we don't do that, then there's a rebound effect where you have the development of new diseases and things like that, which, and just the degradation of society, where we start reducing the amount of people that we can support on the planet, reducing the amount of biology we can support on the planet, reducing the amount of technology that we're employing, which is based on discovery. And there's just attrition that sets in. So you have effects right now which are very clear, like down in Haiti, which is a complete disaster area, which we need to do something about. There are now new diseases that are popping up kind of out of nowhere, like new types of malaria that are not, they're not treatable in the normal way. And it's a malaria that isn't a known form of malaria in the area. So either it was imported or it is some type of new malaria that sprung up because we've created a giant petri dish down there in an area that's already susceptible to this type of thing. It's a very degraded society beforehand, which is intentionally degraded by the British Empire.
Basically, the universe is creative, we're creative, and we need to find, we need to use our creativity to find the solutions to our problems. Like, is that what you're saying? Basically? That's what it is. The universe is creative, we're creative, and let's keep on being creative to find solutions to our problems. No?
Yeah, but there's a difference. Yeah, you also have to know, like, what it means to be creative. Because, like, being creative doesn't mean going and banging out a couple keys on a keyboard or something like that.
No, but I didn't mean musically, but I meant, like, creatively looking for solutions to problems, like, to different fields. Like, is that what you mean?
Yeah, and that there are implications of that.
Okay. And my second question is, I find that creativity needs a mind. Like, you can't be creative without having a mind. If you're saying that the universe is creative, and you mentioned this before, but basically you believe in a higher intelligence, like a God, some people would call it, or creativity cannot come without a mind.
Right, exactly.
So you're saying all of life and everything has come about through a creator. I believe this too, but I'm just asking.
Yeah.
No, it's not possible.
The creator of the universe, yeah.
Yeah.
Because if you look at the universe, if you look honestly at, I mean, the easiest way to recognize this is to just look at how human creativity works, which you're really not going to get a sense of unless you sweep away, so to speak, a lot of the garbage that we get in school and replace it with the study of people who are actually creative, like Kepler, Gauss. Archytas is a good thing to start with. LaRouche is a good thing to look at. But how is it that human beings are able to increase the amount of people we can hold on the planet, for example? Because we've got 6.5, almost 7 billion people on the planet, which is way more than any chimpanzee could sustain planet-wide. Like, if you look at the population of chimpanzees, it's pretty low. Some would say it's because humans are just assholes, but if you look at the population of any animal that has our type of metabolism, you couldn't have 6.5 to 7 billion of them on the planet. You can have us on the planet, not because we're selfish, but because we've figured out how to change our environment to support more people. And every single advance in that capability has come about through an application of scientific discovery. And the substance of that discovery is recognizing that there are principles of the universe that are not sensible. The big corrupting, you know, if you read the subject of Lynn's new paper on the British, is that the number one obstacle we've got with any policymaker today is that they believe that the universe is sense perceptible, that the universe is based on only what you can sense, and therefore it's statistical. But if you look at any scientific worker, every time it's the discovery of some type of unseen principle through juxtaposition of the senses, which allow an increased control and ordering over the universe, which economically results in a development of the ability of sustaining more people on the planet per square foot, per square kilometer. The only way that kind of thing would take place is if creativity were already existing in the universe. It's not an epiphenomenon of life. So therefore, there has to be a creator of the universe, or else creativity wouldn't exist.
Yeah.
Or else, I mean, it'd be strange that creativity suddenly, like, turned on when first hominid walked around.
Okay. But, your personal thoughts on like, if there's this creator, that would be like the most important question for me. Like, do you have thoughts on this creator? Like, do you have any personal thoughts, like, or the movement? Like, what do you think about this creator? Like, what is he? He just left us like this, or
huh?
Like, this creator has just created us and left the universe. Like, is there? What's his equation in all of this? Like, his role?
No, that's the whole point. It's not like, I mean, look, you have Christian fundamentalism, which is really ripe and rampant, and it's just really tough, where people try to find various ways to, like, get in with God, you know, like, you know, accept Jesus. You have these, like, various lines, various phrases that supposedly give you some kind of power over God so that God will, you know, make your life better and give you a seat in heaven or somewhere like that after death. But that's not Christianity. That's a big, essentially political cult to make you not politically effective at all. Because then you can just sit there and just say, oh, you know, I accept Jesus Christ as my personal savior. And then you can go out and try to get more people to say that. And, you know, to read Bible phrases and throw around, you know, little sentences from the Bible and say, you know, this means this, this means that. But, you know, real religion is, most religions on the planet today are, you know, sorry, they're pretty much cults.
Yeah.
Because there's no scientific backing to them, and there's no real understanding of what it means to be in the image of God through the discovery of new physical principles.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
Yeah, it sounds like you're saying the universe is willfully created, not randomly created.
Yeah.
That's just like that's just like a comment, like, just to say off what you just said. And that you come to know the creator by making discoveries.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the way you see this in economics is that if you don't make new discoveries, then your culture is going to collapse. You've seen this over and over and over through the history of people on the earth. If you don't make new discoveries and new interventions, then your economy is going to fall apart at some point through attrition.
So
therefore, it's willful in both directions. You can decide not to be creative too.
Yeah.
So from that sense, just knowing how the human mind works, creativity is something that's a willful domain.
Just on the subject of cosmic rays, because I had heard like a hypothesis on the television that cosmic rays were responsible for mutation of DNA by breaking the structures of DNA, and when DNA reformed itself, it took on a new structure. And this was because of the effect of cosmic radiation on the living, on the molecules of the living organisms, or that's what they seem to say. And the second part of that question is, if that's true, does that mean we have to figure out how cosmic radiation reacts on the Earth, and we have to simulate that in a space orbit? Because you mentioned circadian rhythms. If a person needs to sleep on a trip to Mars, you might need to figure that out if it's sort of responsible for sleep. You know, you can't just give them drugs every 12 hours or something.
Or
whatever.
Yeah, you're gonna have to do something. We don't know what you're going to have to do is the whole point. That's why we need to go out in space. But in terms of the cosmic rays and mutations of DNA, first of all, it's not clear that DNA controls the expression of your morphology. It's not clear that DNA is what defines everything. For example, there are more. The standard model is that DNA is the whole code of all the proteins that you need inside your body, all the proteins and enzymes that you need in your body to function. But what we find is that there are a whole lot more proteins in your body than DNA, so that there's a lot of your body which is not coded by DNA, is not determined by DNA. And there's a whole lot of DNA that isn't even coded as proteins. We don't know what it does. It's called like junk DNA. It's something like 20 or 30% of the human genome, large sections of which, funny enough, are actually identified as virus DNA. And when a virus infects you, it injects its DNA into your cell, and then it goes and inserts itself as a section of your DNA. So now you have a section, you have DNA, and boom, you run into virus DNA, and you get back to your own DNA. And the typical thing is that that DNA, that virus DNA, will cause the cell to begin pumping out new viruses, and eventually the cell will burst open. It will lyse and spill out all these new viruses. Anyhow, so the function of DNA is just not well understood. One interesting thing is that DNA has the ability to repair itself, that when you have a mitosis of a cell, you get the DNA essentially replicates itself and becomes two, so that both cells have exactly the same DNA. But the problem is that you do have coding error. It's a long chain. It's like one long, really long sentence. But you have errors that pop up in the chain, which can then be repaired. So one important question is, if they can be repaired, but yet DNA is the entire code of life, then where does the code that repairs the code come from? All right. So just on the first point, it's not clear that DNA is the determinant of the expression of your form and so forth. There is a relationship, obviously, but it's not as direct as is being promoted in a lot of the scientific literature. Now, in terms of cosmic rays causing mutations, this is a very important subject. One of the first guys to hypothesize this was a German paleontologist named Otto Schindelbel, who was like a godfather of paleontology, and known as the number one ardent opposition to neo-Darwinism. But he went through a big investigation to find out what was causing accelerations and decelerations of the rate of evolution. And he showed that there's really no terrestrial event that can cause a global change in evolution. So he thought we need to talk to the astronomers and find out what these cosmic rays do to us. Now, at this point, we don't know what cosmic rays do to biology. We know a lot about what they do to weather. But when a cosmic ray passes through the atmosphere, it creates what's called an air shower, which is it's moving much faster than the speed of light that is measured in the atmosphere. So it just busts up a whole lot of stuff in the air and causes a shower of secondary particles, which reach the surface of the Earth, and we measure the event with large tanks of water that can essentially pick up these air showers. Now, when a cosmic ray reaches your body, more often than not, it passes right through really freaking fast. But sometimes it could hit. We don't know what mechanism causes it to decide to hit or not hit. And we don't know what would happen. We know that it causes dramatic air showers in the atmosphere. You'd think that that would cause an effect inside of your body. And one thing that we do, a lot of astronauts who are on the International Space Station report things like, seeing little streaks of light and things like that in their eye, which don't register as actual visible light. But they see streaks, which they think is actually cosmic rays passing through the vitreous humor inside your eye, the liquid inside your eye. So that's something that needs to be studied. I don't have any good answers for you on the effects of cosmic rays on DNA. Both aspects need to be studied. What DNA has to do with heredity and what the cosmic rays have to do.
But you were right before that it can't be explained just by chemistry. You have to go outside of that into like the realm of physics and radiation and its properties.
Yeah, we need to begin doing experimental evolution, which we're not going to do until we get into space and we can have a controlled domain where we can see what the effects of this stuff is on life directly. Because on the Earth, it's actually very difficult to register cosmic rays. We can create synthetic cosmic rays inside of fusion reactors and particle accelerators. But so far, that's one of the problems with science actually right now, is that you have people doing work in various domains, but there's no coming together. So part of our work is to get a lot of these guys together. Like one biologist we talked to who's studying this kind of effect said, look, all we need to do is take like a little petri dish of bacteria and just stick it next to CERN. We need to stick it next to the Large Hadron Collider and just see what happens when this stuff hits the bacteria. Those guys at CERN they don't need to know what the experiment is. Just let us set this thing next to the Large Hadron Collider and we'll take it back and we'll see what happens. Because this kind of science is very, very rare right now.
Thanks for the answer.
Real quick, you were talking about the explanation of DNA being the entire framework for living organisms, you stated, if I got this correctly, that there are some proteins in the human body not coded for by DNA?
We haven't found a code for a lot of them. I don't have any examples off the top of my head.
Okay. That struck me as something pretty significant for the... Well, in any case, when you were talking about yeast differentiating between enantiomers of tartaric acid or whatever, and how that was evidence for the fact that life cannot be explained solely on solely by chemical means. But I don't really see how that's necessary. Certain proteins of certain handedness, if they're present in yeasts, could react with other proteins of only a certain, you know, handedness as well. I was wondering if you could respond to that.
Yeah, well, in this part, again, I should say there's a video that just went up recently called Pasteur, The Science of Life, which I recommend everybody there watch. It's very good. Which goes through some of the science behind Pasteur. But essentially, Pasteur was looking at the effects of yeast on a particular type of acid, tartaric acid, which his you know, significant contribution was to crystallize the acid and recognize that the crystals of the acid are shaped in like mirror images of each other.
Yeah, I understand that.
When they're super small. And so what he did is he recognized this is apparently a known effect. There's something called the polarization of light, which itself is not well understood. There's like a mathematical model of it, but that's based on essentially how we can get polarization to happen. It's not really known what polarization itself is. But it was shown that this tartaric acid, after fermentation, it exists before fermentation, but after fermentation, if you dissolve the tartaric acid in a solution, that solution will take polarized light and rotate its plane of polarization, some amount in one direction, always the same direction. But before fermentation, if you take the same acid, dissolve it in solution, send polarized light through it, it won't do anything. It comes out the other side like it was just water. And they had seen this effect with quartz crystals, that quartz will also take polarized light and rotate its plane when it goes through the crystal. But if you pulverize the crystal or melt it and make glass out of it, it loses this this optical property. So it's an optical property, for one thing. It's not a chemical property. Pasteur took some of this pre-fermentation tartaric acid, crystallized it, and then by hand separated he called them left-handed and right-handed mirror images, separated them into two piles, and then dissolved each one and showed that one pile would rotate the light one way, the other pile would rotate the other way. So, thus proving that the rotation was due to which isomer you used. But it was something that you can't... the chemical properties are exactly the same of these acids. And you went through the experiment, went through the laundry list of experiments. But he took a solution of what he called the racemic acid, which had both hands, it didn't rotate like this, before fermentation, put some yeast in it and fermented it, and actually showed that as it was fermenting, polarized light that went through slowly rotated until the fermentation was done, and then the rotation stopped. So, and then he crystallized it and showed that it was indeed all only left-handed crystals. So, and these were the crystals that he was separating. When it's dissolved, they're no longer crystals, they're molecules. Somehow the yeast was differentiating between molecules, which the yeast probably couldn't see. Yeast don't have eyes. Somehow they're determining which molecule to pick based on what we only know as an electromagnetic effect, not a chemical effect. So from that, Pasteur said, therefore, there's something more at work in life that doesn't exist in chemistry, because chemistry can't differentiate between optical properties.
But as I understand it, biological molecules, a lot of them are pretty complex, such that also biological molecules also exhibit certain conformations, right? And
like amino acids, for example.
Right.
Amino acids have left and right-handed.
Exactly. Certain type of molecule of certain conformation will only react with one optical isomer of a molecule as opposed to the other. And that, at least I believe, I mean, this is what I learned in
physics. No, that's the point. That's not true.
It's not true.
No, they'll react with either. It's chemically the same.
Because I thought that the spatial orientation of what of the atoms or whatnot was important in the reaction to take place.
That's the whole point. Not inside of biology. If you take a left-handed amino acid and a right-handed amino acid of the same kind, they're chemically the same. Even the linking up of parts of the protein are, if you do it chemically, it doesn't matter which hand you use, you can still create the same things, the same molecules. But then, like, the folding that has to take place won't happen, for example.
Right.
But the selection of the links in the chain can only be selected through a living process. Unless, you know, man comes along and, you know, separates all the left isomers from the right isomers and then, you know, does the reaction.
All right, well, that's interesting. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I can only take, like, one more question or so. I need to get going soon.
I don't really have to ask this question, but... No.
Go ahead.
Okay, yeah, Pete.
Yeah.
I had two questions. I have to pick one of them. All right. I guess the one I wanted to satisfy a little bit more was in regards to a reference you made at the beginning of your presentation. When you said that the universe expanding is something which we have simply assumed, but there's no scientific evidence for. Now, I've done a little bit of research where I've come across certain things like redshift and what have you. To explain the rate of changing distances of the galaxies and stars from each other. Could you maybe elaborate a little bit more how we got to the current thinking or belief that things are the way they are, like 14 million, billion years old, as far as the universe is concerned, and how that's wrong? Or how the... Yeah.
Go through 14
billion. Yeah, that's a good question. the way I'll answer this is that it is a matter of being a responsible scientific investigator. And a lot of scientists today, they kind of forget about that part and they go way off. Yeah, indeed, a lot of the things that we see that are far away from us are red-shifted. In other words, the spectrum is shifted to become redder. So something that's a specific color of red will actually be redder than things that are far away from us. And there's a lot of ways that could be explained, but to take that as evidence that the entire universe is expanding, and then to draw the corollary that therefore it must have all exploded at some point in the distant past, relies on what we already know of terrestrial physics. In other words, it's drawing from science that we've done on the Earth, and scientific breakthroughs that were done on the Earth, and then extrapolating just simple experiments on the Earth and saying, oh, the universe acts like that. The universe does that, what we've discovered down here. As opposed to starting from the standpoint of Kepler, which is, we don't know how the universe works yet. We're going to investigate it based on how the functions of the mind work. And juxtapose and discover undiscovered principles, as opposed to taking things that you already know and say, oh, you know, out there I see this weird phenomenon. We must already know the answer to it. We must already know how it works. So I'm going to try to shoehorn what are very, very good and important observations into, you know, a small-minded theory. The idea of the expansion of the universe, it was a... It's funny, the word Big Bang is actually designed as a joke to make fun of the idea that the whole universe started at a little point at some distant point in the past. So it's an issue of scientific rigor and a scientific responsibility to say, we're observing phenomena in the universe which are completely strange and completely wild, that are probably not mimicking simple experiments that we've done on the Earth, and not mimicking principles that we think we already know. Because the universe actually is, you know, unbounded, but the universe is also finite in the sense that if you try to take your observations of space, a space phenomenon, and then try to shoehorn them into what's already known, you're never going to make a discovery. And all these phenomena in the solar, in the universe and the solar system are, you're just putting them into essentially a Euclidean box, saying all this stuff is explainable in terms of the first principles of Euclid, and there's nothing more to discover in the universe, which as has been shown over and over and over in the history of man, the universe doesn't work like that. We don't know what's happening in the universe. There's a lot of what we don't know. So we should have the courage and the obligation to recognize that we don't know what the principles are yet, but go out to discover what they are, which means we have to do experiment and also not be bound by a lot of the like dirty underwear. You know, we should get rid of the dirty underwear and the dirty diapers and leave those with in the graves of Newton and Galileo and Descartes, and go for making real discoveries. So I don't know if that answered the question, but
it sounds like you're seeing the difference between the scientist and the sophist is that one proceeds by acknowledging his ignorance, while the other guy proceeds with the belief that he knows it already, or it could be explained by what he knows already.
Yeah. Yeah, but the first guy, you got to recognize that there are discoveries that were made that you got to rediscover too, you know. So that's the narrow path. But yeah, that's essentially right.
Okay, thank you, Peter.
So, yeah, you're welcome. Fun. Good talking to you guys.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Pete.
All right, have fun.